Blog Talk Radio.
And hello out there to all you Bedford and Sullivan folks, Brooklyn folks. This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan podcast, coming at you live from East Flatbush. And we have a veteran of the show, on the show tonight. He's given us our first Giants briefing of 2016, and that is Gary Mintz of the New York Giants Preservation Society. Gary, Happy New Year.
Sam, Happy New Year to you and all of your faithful listeners. I wish everybody a year of health, happiness, prosperity, and maybe either a Giants or a Mets World Championship.
I like the either-or. Obviously, you know, I'm hoping that the even season for you doesn't happen as it has been in this decade, but, you know, maybe we'll get a chance to battle that one out. We'll talk about 2016 as it relates to, both the Mets and the Giants. Why not? We'll see where the podcast goes. But unfortunately, we do have to start on a somber note, and that is the passing of Giants legend Monty Irvin. Gary, obviously you didn't see him play, but it's interesting. I actually got a chance to talk to him briefly, and unfortunately we weren't able to get him on the show. But give us a little bit of what you have learned about Monty Irvin over the years and the legend that is Monty Irvin.
Okay. First of all, the first time I came associated with Monty Irvin was from my father. My father would just spew out names, Alvin Blackie Dark. You know, he would always call him. It was always Monty Irvin, and then he would say the Orange Cutie. And I never, I guess I was silly. Never asked him where he got that. But as it turns out, he was from Orange, New Jersey, Monty Irvin, and Cutie. He was always smiling. So that's where that nickname came from, the Orange Cutie. He always called him that. I had the pleasure of speaking to him once. He was in a sort of like a nursing facility in Houston. I think he was living on his own in like an assisted living. What a nice, respectful man. And, you know, he had all of his thoughts together like I said, I'd never met him in person. Never saw him play, but I've done a lot of research, and just a trailblazer, one of the first African-Americans to play the game, came up with the Giants, formed the first African-American outfield with Hank Thompson and Willie Mays. Just an extraordinary man. Later, after his playing days were over, he worked with the Commissioner of Baseball, so well-rounded individual, and unfortunately he was the oldest of the surviving New York Giants, which now numbers only 23.
Yeah, and
living members.
Unfortunately that's how, life goes, and that number will keep dwindling as legacies are made, and you keep the history alive, and that it just, as long as we have all this kind of access online, and I'm able to go right to Monty Irvin's statistics, including apparently his Negro League statistics and what they were able to compile through that, it looked like he started in the major leagues in 1951, which is obviously a big year for the Giants. Dodgers side of things would not like to hear about, but yes, go ahead.
He actually came up in 49.
Oh, 49. Oh, there we go. 49. I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting statistic that I did some research myself. And after the Giants won in 1954, in 1955, he wasn't playing too well. He was actually sent down to the minor leagues, which, would seem
like... Yeah, Minneapolis.
Right,
level
and I know what an astute fan you are. Today we have this Rule 5 draft where a lot of these guys, some guys get picked and not household names, and they have to remain on the major league roster for the whole year for the team to keep. Monty Irvin actually was claimed by the Chicago Cubs, in 1956 in the Rule 5 draft, and that's how he finished his career with the Cubs.
So they left him. They basically left him off because they thought he was washed up at 36.
They thought he was done.
That's remarkable. You look back at here. They actually, you know, they're able to compile everywhere. He played for the, I guess that was the Newark Eagles, right?
That's correct.
Right. So and then Jersey City. So he's from Orange. So I mean, he's a Jersey guy.
That's exactly right. You know, and all the obituaries that were written about him. Willie Mays said he was, you know, a tutor to him. You know, Mays looked up to him as a father figure, even though Mays is going to be 85. It was only, you know, 11-year difference in their ages. Ervin died. He was going to be 97 in February. But for somebody a father figure when, you know, more like a big brother, really, but called him a father figure. So, and there was a lot of talk about that he was almost too nice of a guy to be the first African-American brought up, and some people say that's why Robinson was the first.
Just because of the reputation of fighting back, because what's so interesting about that was that he picked somebody who did have a history of fighting back as considering he was before Rosa Parks did what she did in terms of the back of the bust, he was doing that in the Army, military. He wanted that kind of stoic, not stoic, but that kind of hard type of shell, because, you know, obviously Branch Rickey had to, he didn't want him to fight back for those first few years.
That's correct.
That's interesting. And it's kind of similar to the way Roy Campanella and Jackie Robinson were compared.
Right. But really, anything you read or anybody saying anything, he kind of brought a smile to everybody's face. He was just a well-respected, beautiful man. And unfortunately, he lost a lot of great year. I mean, if you look at his statistic with the Giants, you know, one great, really great year. But he lost so much time because of the color of the skin. But he was, in fact, honored in the Hall of Fame based on his work in the Negro Leagues.
Right, exactly. I mean, you look at it, it's from 1938 to 1957, he played baseball, age 19. And in the Negro League, that was 9 seasons, he compiled a .354 batting average with a .393 on-base percentage and a .532 slugging. And in modern terms, that's an OPS of .924. He had 20 home runs and 135 RBIs, 17 stolen bases, walked 36 times. The amount of plate appearances were 613. So I'm guessing, I mean, they don't really have the records of how many games he played, but it sounds like they played a lot fewer games.
Right.
I have to get our Negro League Museum friends back on the air to give us a little bit more of a details regarding that. Going to the minor leagues, I mean, he batted .375 in the minor leagues. Obviously, he was, by the time he got to Jersey City, he was 30 years old. So he was
right.
There's a reason why he had .373 that year.
Yeah, I mean, his statistic with the Giants, he had 2 great years with the Giants, but, you know, he had come up in 49. He was already 30 years old. So
50,
most...
It seemed like he had a breakout year in 50 where, I mean, he walked 52 times, struck out only 41, and his plate appearances went up to .432, and he had 112 hits, 19 doubles. That's good. 15 home runs and 66 RBIs. You know, he produced more power. And again, we need to know how many games he played in the Negro Leagues, but, you look at his, in 1951, he had an unbelievable year of .312 batting average, .415 on base percentage, .415 on base percentage. That is productive.
Amazing.
.514 slugging, 24 home runs and 121 RBIs.
And he only missed 3 games.
And
played 151
out of
154.
151,
out of
154.
Yep.
Now, 52, he only played 46 games. And I know you might not know it since you weren't around at the time, but do you have any idea, is that just injury or was that military based?
That I don't know. I believe he was in the military.
Okay.
I read something that he had something to do with the military, so it could have been, you know, Mays also missed, you know, 52 and 53.
I mean, it looked like his next best year was 1953 with 21 home runs, 97 RBIs, 329 batting average, 406 on base percentage, 541 slugging. And
yeah, they also say statistics don't show the real things.
Right.
Superb outfielder, great base runner. He was all around. He just unfortunately came up late, and you know. That's
well, I also think a big flaw of baseball statistics from the get-go is that they never had you have this almost immeasurable offensive categories and then nothing really for defense, hardly anything
right.
other than just errors and fielding percentage. And I don't think they've ever really mastered. And that's what the modern technology and modern statistics are trying to do with defense. I mean, because, you know, when you really think about it, like somebody like Keith Hernandez could easily be Hall of Fame.
Right.
Maybe I'm biased. But.
Defensively, no doubt about it. He was, Hernandez was best first baseman I ever saw in my time, defensively.
Right. And he could certainly swing the bat and did so for about 10 to 12 years well until injuries caught up with him.
Sam,
so
you know, during the Mets heyday, during the Mets' heyday in the 80s, when you needed a clutch hit, I think you wanted him up more than Strawberry, more than Carter. You wanted Hernandez in that batter's box.
Exactly. But that's for a whole other podcast. Going
Absolutely.
Back over Monty Irvin's career, he did start to, like you said, especially in 1955, he had been sent down to Minneapolis. And he only hit one home run and 17 RBIs with a .253 batting average. He was basically Ruben Tejada this year because he had an on-base percentage of .337.
Right.
And then with Chicago Cubs in 1956, it actually, you know, wasn't half bad.
He had a decent year, absolutely.
Yeah. He had less plate appearances, meaning he was obviously in 111 games, so he obviously – had a role. I don't know how the 56 Cubs, and you know, I'm actually very curious right off the bat to see where that is. But he batted .271, .346 on base percentage, slugging was .460, on OPS was .807. I'd take that on my team any day of the week, you know. And then what's really interesting is for the Brooklyn affiliate. Oh wow, 1957 for the Brooklyn affiliate, he was 38 years old. He played four games, 11 plate appearances, 10 at bats, so I'm guessing he walked once or got hit by a pitch or something. And he batted .300, .364 on base percentage, .600 slugging, .964 of OPS, but those numbers mean nothing in the amount of plate appearances he had. Do you know anything about this?
I saw he was in the PCL in that last year. But like I said,
Los Angeles PCL because they had swapped it with the Cubs.
Right. I was really, like I said, when I was doing a little research on him, I'm a school teacher, and I wrote a baseball trial this year, and Monty Irvin is actually one of the witnesses in this trial I'm doing. So when I was researching it, I was, like I said, very shocked about this, that he was sent to the minors from the Giants, and that Rule 5 thing really, like, stuck to me because, like I said to you, and you know, most of these guys are people you never heard of. It's not usually a veteran. That's how baseball has changed in, 60 years since that happened.
Right.
In my trial, I'm doing a baseball trial in Horace Stoneham, and the all African outfield are all considered to be witnesses saying that Horace Stoneham, you know, brought up a lot of African Americans, and one of the kids who was playing Monty Irvin said, you know, my name is Monty Irvin, you know, blah blah blah, and then he died last week, and I had to change it to, you know, I am the ghost of Monty Irvin now. So he will always be remembered, and the kids, you know, the guy who's playing him, they're only in fifth grade, they don't know any better from reading the paper, but you know, I cut out the article for him, and I wanted him to know that the guy he's portraying, not that he was dead, but really existed, and he was considered to be, you know, an elite baseball player.
Looking at this, it's interesting, looking at the Wikipedia page, because I wanted to find out about the Los Angeles element. So it looks like a back injury, this is according to Wikipedia, a back injury led to Irvin's retirement as a player and sustained the injury during spring training that year and only appeared in 4 minor league games for the Los Angeles Angels of the Pacific Coast League. So it looks like, and I'm going to have to obviously delve deep into this element of it for the end, the potential end of the series, is that he was picked up by the Dodgers after the Cubs year and unfortunately just didn't work out. Going back, however, he was going a little earlier to what, as we were talking about in terms of Jackie Robinson, this is according to Wikipedia, he was approached in 1945 by Brooklyn Dodgers executive Branch Rickey about being signed for the major leagues, but Irvin felt he was not ready to play at that level so soon after leaving the service. The Newark Eagles business manager, Effa Manley, would not let Rickey sign Irvin without compensation. Rickey had already obtained Robinson without paying for his rights to his Negro League club, said Irvin. From a purely business standpoint, Mrs. Manley felt that Branch Rickey was obligated to compensate her for my contract. That position probably delayed my entry into the major league. Mrs. Manley told Rickey that he had taken Don Newcomb for no money, but she wasn't going to let him take me without some compensation. Furthermore, if he tried to do it, she would sue and fight him in court. Rickey contacted her to say he was no longer interested and released me, and the Giants picked up my contract.
You know, getting back to what we, you know, he Irvin was in the service, but upon further review, the reason he missed all his games in 52 was that he got hurt, broken leg.
Broken leg.
Yeah.
Injuries, they're unfortunately an unavoidable part of the game and a part of life. And may we continue, many of us, to be extremely lucky to
absolutely
have avoided.
One other thing about Irvin that, you know, besides being honored in the Hall of Fame and everything, is that in 2010 the Giants finally retired his number. And that was based, you know, more on his Negro League statistics and abilities than playing for the Giants. But nonetheless, recognition was probably long overdue.
Completely agree. And I'm looking at the photo on Wikipedia of that ceremony. Looking also, just to we'll wrap up Monty Irvin on this, he worked for Rheingold Beer. He was a scout for the New York Mets from 67 to 68, and then he moved to the commissioner's office in public relations under Bowie Kuhn.
68. Yep.
And he was
By
the
way, I know I'm a little older than you, of course, Sam, but when I was growing up, just to interject here, Jackie Robinson, all I remembered him was having white hair, and he worked for a drinking firm. Do you know who that was?
Chock full of nuts.
You, home run right there, man. Very good. he was the spokesman.
That was grand
Chock
slam,
full
right?
of nuts. That was a grand slam. Nice job. But I remember I was maybe 9 years old. It was like 1970, I remember, and he, I guess, was sick or just all I remember he had his afro was all white, and he worked for Chock full of nuts.
Yeah,
but
he unfortunately died early because of diabetes as well.
Yeah, Monty Irvin, I think, might have been the first African American to work with Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner at the time.
Yeah,
he was really, like, you know, like I said, really totally respected by the game, and everybody, nobody ever said a bad word about him.
And you will certainly be missed. And with that, for the podcast at least, we certainly closed the book on Monty Irvin. But
yeah,
we'll
would think the Giants this year might honor him by wearing a patch, maybe a 20 or something
on their
sleeve.
I think that would be would be the classy move for sure. And the Giants have. Since McGowan, at least, took over, have shown the class. So,
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, since that era, and obviously it's under different ownership now, but they've done a great job in honoring their past, and especially their New York roots. And speaking of that, I was just walking around Brooklyn tonight, and I saw somebody in a blue L.A. Dodgers cap, and I immediately just
did you get
I
sick?
Guess just because I got I not even exactly I just got well it's blasphemy. It there's something that's not right about seeing that walking around Brooklyn, and obviously the person wearing it's not necessarily thinking of that type of connection, you know. But at the same time, it gets me thinking, you know. I've jumped into the deep end of Brooklyn Dodgers lore, and I understand their perspective. And on my way home, I saw an SF, actually, which is really ironic that I had the two contrasts, in Brooklyn. I saw somebody wearing an SF hat, and I said to myself, it's just not the same feeling. Yes, mind you, I have, like I said, jumped into the deep end of Brooklyn Dodgers lore, but at the same time, I think I have an understanding that it just wasn't the same, and maybe that's Willie Mays, maybe that's just Walter O'Malley and the way he left being the most profitable team in baseball, at least in the National League. You know, it's interesting divide.
There's much more hatred toward the Dodgers. They were so tightly woven into the fabric of the community in Brooklyn. The players live near the ballpark. A lot of them walk there. They were beloved. The Giants were loved, but in a different way. It was, you know, the neighborhoods were different. It was a total different feeling. I believe so. When the Dodgers announced they were leaving, it killed the whole community. Whereas when the Giants left, it probably killed the fans and not necessarily the community. And many of them, you know, stayed partisan to the Giants even when they left. I know my dad did. That's why I'm a Giant fan. I became a Giant fan in 1969. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't around for when they were, you know, in New York. But he never...
And that's what's so interesting is that it coincided, obviously, with such an unbelievable Mets run. And so you became a big Giants fan in 1969. How many miles from Shea again?
I live in Huntington. I live about 30 miles from Citi Field, Shea Stadium.
Right.
Sam, my first game, 69, Mets, Giants, 0-0. Juan Marichal still pitching in the bottom of the 14th inning. Gary Gentry pitched for the Mets. He went 9 innings. Anyway, in the bottom of the 14th inning, I asked my father to take me to the bathroom, and my father refused. So he had my brother take me, and we went into the stall there, and then all of a sudden we heard this roar, loud roar, and we ran out to see the field, and Tommy Agee was rounding third base. He had a home run. Mets beat the Giants 1-0. Juan Marichal went 13, and I don't know if it was a third or two-thirds inning, lost 1-0. That was my introduction to baseball.
Was that Wednesday, May 28th?
I believe it was in August.
August. So they were already in the middle of their run. Because I found a May 28th 1-0 win over the Giants. Where'd it go? Over the Giants. Where'd it go? Here we go. Oh, that was the Padres. What am I talking about? Let's get out of here.
I am pretty sure it was August.
It was right before the Giants came into town. And
it might have been like August 9th, maybe somewhere around there.
No, you nailed it. August 19th. Good call on the 9. 19th. My favorite number, by the way. what's interesting about that is the game I first saw, which ended up being a Padres game before the Giants came in. McGraw was the winning pitcher, and this was 14 innings. Sent the Mets record to 67-51, still 8 games behind the Cubs at the time. 1-0 win in 14 with a Marichal loss. So Marichal was going, I mean, this isn't the game he pitched that, 220-something?
No, that was against Warren Spahn when he won 1-0. That's considered to be the greatest game ever pitched, actually.
Between the two of them, right?
Yes.
That's from Zed, yeah. So what's crazy looking at this, and to go off on a Mets tangent real quick, is that
and let me tell you, Sam, in 1969 as an 8-year-old, first following the game, all I remember, even though I love the Giants, the Mets just never lost from August till
right.
like the end of the year. Anytime you turn the TV on, they won like every game.
That right there, 1, 2, 3, 4, was their fifth win in a row of six before they lost to the Giants in 11 innings, 7-6, where McMahon, what's his first name? Let's see.
Don McMahon.
Don McMahon, thank you. Don McMahon was the winning pitcher, and Ron Taylor was the losing pitcher for the Mets. But after that, they beat the Dodgers and, in fact, swept the Dodgers 5-3, 3-2, 7-4. And at that point, so going back to the 1-0 game that you were at, the Mets were 8 games behind, and then the next day were 7, halted at 7, and then 6-6, 5.5, and I guess Sunday, August 24th, they had a day off before a doubleheader. And that because of whatever the Cubs were able to do in between, I guess the Cubs kept losing. By Tuesday, August 26th, they were only 3.5 behind the Cubs for first place. And basically, as you look at it, they kind of, you know, tiptoed their way towards it. You know, at September 1st, 2nd, 3rd, they settled into 5 games. But then all of a sudden, and it's coinciding with playing the Phillies and then the Cubs coming in, and those are probably the two games that everybody always talks about, the cat, the black cat, because
right.
all of a sudden the Mets are 1.5 games, then 0.5 games, and then they never look back.
One other thing about the 69 Mets and, you know, the Mets in general that I'll always remember, probably the most underrated pitcher maybe in my lifetime was Jerry Kuzman. Guy was
yeah.
a gamer, never got the recognition, you know, he deserved. He was... I mean, talk about Seaver being so great. This guy was like 1B. He was terrific.
Yeah, and it is, you know, he didn't finish well record-wise with the Mets, although he kind of, that all had to do with the fact that they were not as good of a team. Had some pretty good years. He went to Philly, and it's so crazy that some two Mets that are so attributed to 1969 New York Mets are also... And probably, and definitely Tug McGraw more than Jerry Kuzman, attributed to the Philadelphia Phillies.
I remember Kuzman on the Twins more than anything after he left the Mets.
Am I going crazy? Hold on.
You're going. He finished up. I'm looking now at his stats. 84 and 85 on the Phillies, but most of his he spent years in Minnesota. He won 20 games. In Minnesota,
right? You know, the thing about Tug McGraw is he is kind of viewed by both teams to be legends.
Absolutely, as is Lenny Dykstra.
Yeah, and I'd have to say that the Phillies got more of the steroid end of Lenny Dykstra than we did.
Absolutely correct, and the nuttiness of him too. He's a nut.
Well, we're coming up on the end of the. Of the live parts of our show. Unfortunately for our audience, they're going to have to listen to the what we have to say after the 30 minutes is up about the 2016 Giants. So in the last minute that we have, Gary, before we talk a little bit more in depth in the archive side of the show that you can access on Blog Talk Radio, everybody, discuss a little bit what you hope to be another even season for your 2016 Giants team.
This first time, and you know, even when they won the World's Championships 3 out of the last 6 years now, I never went into the season thinking we were going to win. I have very good vibes about this year. I think the major disappointments last year were lack of starting pitching, and I know there are some question marks about Cueto and Samardzija. But boy, oh boy, compared to what we had, I mean, we had, you know, a washed up Tim Hudson last year. Tim Lincecum, I can never say anything bad about him, but, you know, done. You know, and Matt Cain, done last year, hopefully comes back this year. not much confidence in Jake Peavy. Now all these guys have slid back. And, you know, Madison Bumgarner, terrific, you know, ace. I'm very confident this year. And the best move that happened all winter for the Giants was Zach Greinke going to Arizona. Just getting him away from Kershaw was, mentally, that's such an uplifting move, not having to face those two guys. I mean, I don't know how the Mets beat him last year.
But, you know, not having to face them back-to-back, but, I mean, Arizona seems to be trying to revamp. I mean, they've been kind of on the cusp, except not being really able to push towards the top echelon of that division. What do you think of them this year?
I think Arizona's much improved. I don't think they addressed their bullpen at all. I mean, is Brad Ziegler really?
And they gave up Addison Reed.
The Ciardi guy was a very good player. They gave up for Shelby Miller. But, you know, comparing like the Mets and the Diamondbacks, the Mets have Familia. I know he didn't pitch well in the World Series, but Brad Ziegler, to me, is not a major league closer.
Well, let's be honest, going to Yuris, there was really one pitch that he would really want to take back, because everything else I see as circumstantial around it.
The Gordon home run?
The Gordon home run was a quick pitch right after you did a quick pitch, which was just not smart. He got a little too cocky.
Right.
But everything else, I feel as if it was circumstantial. He should have been probably brought in from the beginning of that Tyler Clifford debacle, which ended with the Daniel Murphy error with Familia on the mound. And then everything else, I mean, he got the ground balls that you need to set up what you're supposed to set up, and unfortunately it didn't work out because of some more errors. So
he should be their worst problem. He's, you know, I totally agree with you. I mean, Daniel Murphy, wonderful story with the hitting, but let's call a spade here. He's atrocious at second base. He just is.
And not to say the Mets, like, really got their defense together. That didn't really happen. But what they've done is get players that have been at their positions for a while and know what they're doing. And especially with Neil Walker, I mean, he gets to balls, and he doesn't make the biggest issue for Daniel Murphy on that play was he didn't get in front of the ball. He's lollygagging, even with the runner going into second base. You still got to zone in. It's the World Series. You get in front of that ball. I've seen you do it before. It might have been mental in the field.
You have to be worried. I mean, I know he made plays, but any time the ball was hit to him, I'm just a Giant fan watching. I'd be nervous when the ball was hit to Daniel Murphy. He's just not a good – he's a nice hitter. Neil Walker is not a Gold Glove second baseman, but he's better than Daniel Murphy by far in the field.
Right.
And the Mets have plenty of strikeout pitchers, but despite that, you got to have a good defensive team behind you. And the Mets did not.
Right, exactly. Now, obviously, the Mets are not necessarily done yet, and I want to shift back over to the NL West right after this last point. When looking at the fact that Daniel Murphy went to the Nationals, and the Mets are not necessarily done, but they've obviously, you know, they if you look at what their goal was, to get more versatile and just look like basically play a little bit more of the kind of Kansas City game that got played against them. When you look at that and look at the Nationals, Danny Murphy losing some starting pitch, I mean, like, what do you think? Like, if people are saying that the Nationals are still going to beat the Mets, I mean, they got to be out of their minds. And mind you, anything can happen. It's going to be a crazy season. But on paper right now, I still don't see how the Mets are not the best team in that division alone.
Washington has a lot to prove. When you have pitching,
that's true.
When you have pitching, you're in every game. The Giants won in 2010 with a putrid offense. They had fantastic pitching. The Mets' pitching is better than the Giants' pitching was in 2010. The Mets have phenomenal starting pitching. And they, but the only thing that's missing, and they, you know, Cespedes was a tremendous pickup, and you know, unless Conforto, you know, is as good as he appeared to be, you know, they're going to be, it's going to be like, you know, a lot of games, torture games, 2-1, 3-2. Most nights they're going to come out ahead because of their pitching, but they need that defense. That is the key. You know, Cabrera, is he that much better than Flores at short? It might be a wash. Walker is a better defensive second baseman than Murphy. You know, they got to play. You know, Conforto looks athletic. The thing with the Royals that everybody envies is not this. They have, to me, their starting pitching is very It's kind of crappy. I don't see that. They have athletes at positions who run, who hit. All of their players know how to play the game. That's why they're so good. They got athletes. They all can move. They steal bases. They bunt. They know how to play the game. They don't beat themselves. Big difference. The Mets could have lost the series because they beat themselves. You know, Cespedes kicking balls. Murphy not picking up balls. Duda making just an atrocious throw home. He would have been out by a mile.
And that seems to be what the issue for re-signing Johan Cespedes is, that throughout the game, it's not just with the Mets, people are concerned about a diva reputation and also the idea that once he gets paid, you're not going to get the same effort.
Right.
Everything is pointing, and Terry Collins was coming out quoted on it, is that Cespedes wants to return to New York. And it's kind of right now just about the front office and what they want. Look at the way Cespedes swung at the pitches. I mean, you know, there's a certain style that they're going for, and that's taking pitches. And it really paid off in that Washington game I saw live, where they were down 7-1 in the seventh inning, and I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that, both in the Mets' persistence to keep taking pitches and also the Nats' persistence in not throwing strikes. It was a pretty fascinating thing to watch, and I didn't completely grasp it as I was watching it, exactly what was happening, because I was very visceral in the moment about what was going on.
That whole series could have been the end of Drew Storen's career with the Nationals.
Yes, and that's basically all Mike Rizzo and Matt Williams' fault. Mostly Mike Rizzo, although Matt Williams might have done some of the worst managing that I've ever seen or anybody has ever seen. But Mike Rizzo is the one who never had confidence after that 2012, the way 2012 ended in Drew Storen. And unfortunately, the last thing that he needed was a Jonathan Papelbon, of all people, to come in and take his job away. And
Mike Rizzo,
a ball player, it should, you know, he's a grown man, it's a ball player. But at the same time, I mean, you know your personnel.
Absolutely. Mike Rizzo might have handed the Giants the 2012 World Series. You know, how do you do what he did with Strasburg? And Strasburg's never been the same, but he babied him and didn't let him pitch. I was nervous if the Giants were going to play them with Strasburg, because that's when Strasburg was Strasburg. You know, you can't.
What you want about the World Series, but the Mets handled it properly.
I'm sorry?
No, I said say what you want about the way they performed in the World Series, but in terms of their pitchers, the Mets handled the whole thing properly, and because of Strasburg.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody learned a lesson. You may not get another chance to get somewhere, and you don't bank that you're going to be back next year. And that's what they did, and they're not back.
So speaking of where you guys might be this year, considering this just seems to be a pattern for you, but at the same time, like, you never know. That's what's so remarkable about the run you guys have been on. I'm going to start with the Dodgers, actually. They've lost Greinke. But they have a superstar in their front office. I mean, do you think that they might be almost, like, ironically, in a transitional period, especially with Don Mattingly gone?
I'm sure, you know, they'll develop. They've signed a lot of, you know, players from different country, international market. But again, no matter how you read about the improvement that they might have, not having that 1-2 punch, and again, I was shocked the Mets were able to beat them because of those two guys. I mean, psychologically, when you go into Dodger Stadium now, they don't come in. When they come in, you're not scared of losing 2 out of 3 anymore because you were going to lose those two games if those two guys were pitching. You know, I don't know about this Menta guy. You know, today they signed Joe Blanton. Are you afraid of him?
Officer Joe?
Officer Joe Blanton.
The World Series is almost 10 years ago.
But, I mean, and you knew the Mets, Anderson, the lefty, when he pitched that game? You knew the Mets were going to beat him. I mean, that was a disaster.
And what's his name is down? Hung Chi Ryu?
Yeah, you don't know what's going to happen with him if he's coming back. Scott Kazmir, you don't know what's going to happen with him.
Oh,
he might break down again. Yeah, they signed Scott Kazmir.
Huh. Well, you know, I mean, I think right now Andrew Freeman is kind of like similar to, you know, it's different. He came into a position where they had been winning. But it's clearly, you know, the new ownership attempting to get more sound at going about what they need to go about. Obviously, they've been spending some money, but they want to develop better, and Andrew Freeman can help them do that. I mean, I think
totally
right now it's clear that.
But if I was a Dodger fan, I'd be really upset. I know the money is ridiculous, but again, those two guys. And, you know, if the Mets keep their guys, it's going to be similar to that with the Mets in a year or two. That, you know, anytime DeGrom, Syndergaard, or Harvey pitch, you're thinking if those are the three you're going to be facing, good chance you're going to get swept.
And as a
Giant fan, I was nervous anytime those two guys. First thing I wanted was to get a hit. I didn't want to be no-hitted. And then you try to get a run or two because that's how good those two guys are.
I think that Syndergaard is going to be the one. I mean, I think they're going to keep two. I think in terms of, like, potential long-term, I think they keep two. And I think Syndergaard, however, is probably the most likely to stay with the Mets his entire career. There's just something about, and mind you, like Matt Harvey was a good example of how public perception can turn on a dime. But I think that just Syndergaard built up a lot of goodwill, especially that game where he just came out throwing inside immediately. And he tore New York. He really seems to, like, especially after, like, that spring training incident with the whole food thing and David Wright throwing, yelling at him about eating lunch while I think it was an intra-squad game.
Right.
Talk about a championship year being set in spring training.
The Mets did a phenomenal job. They really did. Unbelievable. And it came because I mentioned it to you before, fantastic pitching and a little bit of luck. Remember, they would not be anywhere had they acquired Carlos Gomez, who's a show-me player, who is not a – they talked about him being a big-time hitter. He's not a big-time hitter. Jonas Cespedes is a big-time hitter. And without him, they wouldn't have got anywhere.
Hopefully they can lock that down, so it's making the pitcher's job easier. Gary, we're coming up on the end of the show, unfortunately. But I just want you to give a quick word, a last word on the Giants and everything we've spoken about.
I would have liked the Giants to try to get a left field. I would have loved Cespedes, of course. The Giants need help in a backup player who I think the Giants or the Mets should really sign. Guy's a freaking winning ball player. And I didn't want to hear the Mets made this big deal about Kelly Johnson nonsense. Juan Uribe is the perfect backup infielder for either the Mets or the Giants. Giants had a great year from Matt Duffy. He needs a break. Juan Uribe is a threat off the bench. great in the clubhouse, as you knew with the Mets. You know, why does he want to go to Cleveland? Is Cleveland's only offering him a contract? If the Giants don't sign him, which the Giants should pursue him, I